Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, my guests are Nick Capasso, director of the Fitchburg Art Museum, and artist James Dye. An exhibition of his work titled The Void, The Wheel, and The Monster is on view at the Fitchburg Art Museum until September 13th, 2026. Nick, James, welcome to the show. Nick, it's always a pleasure to talk to you about things at the Fitchburg Art Museum, but both of you, welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
Now, Nick, I'm going to have you tee up James's show, so talk about it for, okay, for a few minutes before I talk to James.
Okay, so James Dye, Worcester artist, is having a solo exhibition at the Fitchburg Art Museum that runs through September 13th. And the reason that James is having this show is because he was the first prize winner,
yes,
in the 89th Annual Regional Exhibition of Art and Craft, which took place at FAM last summer. So if you win the first prize, your big prize is your very own solo show at the museum.
I think that's a huge thing, Dick, and I mean that sincerely.
Yeah, this is a program that we've been doing since, we've been doing the regional show for 90 years now.
Yeah.
But we instituted this solo show prize in 2013. And it's a way, you know, that's a real prize. And it's a real opportunity for artists in our region to have a professional solo museum exhibition.
Nice. Is there a second runner-up or anything?
Yeah, we have a first prize, second prize, third prize.
Wow.
And then there are all kinds of medium-specific prizes, like, you know, the painting prize and the photography prize, et cetera, et cetera. And
that's,
all of those
Nick, prizes, that's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah, and this is a very long tradition. I think, you know, a lot of people say that, and I have not personally verified this, that the regional exhibition is the longest-running juried museum show in New England.
Wow. Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a real part of our culture here.
I know the Fitchburg Art Museum under your leadership has really become one of the most fascinating museums in Southern New England.
Well, thank you.
I really mean that. It's just incredible the things that you accomplished there. Now, James, I got to talk to you about this show, The Void, The Wheel, and The Monster. It sounds like the tee up for a joke, but talk to me about The Void.
The Void?
Talk to me at end about The Void.
All right. So I think the
For void, you, what does The Void mean?
Well, The Void would be, you know, that's the primal chaos that everything's born from and everything returns to, you know? It's the primal material of the universe. It's that dark and that primal well where all of our first ideas and everything emerge from, and it's what we're trying to connect with and at the same time sort of run from, you know, in our lives. And it's from there that's born these ideas burning in the dark that we really can't express in words or images. So we create this sort of shared unconscious language to try to represent and communicate with this, and that sort of that language forms the foundation for all of our myths and narratives and even our dreams. And it's why there's so many common elements and motifs in all those stories across the world and across all cultures and time, you know?
When I think about the void, I think about the absence of things, but you're saying it's actually everything messed up in sort of a confusion. Is that, am I reading you right?
Yeah. It comes first. And then, you know, first comes the void, and then comes the first spark within the void, and then comes everything, and then everything eventually collapses back into the void. That's sort of the wheel aspect of this, too. It's the eternal cycle.
So I always thought, for me, when I think about the void, I think about the time I was under anesthesia and had a complete absence of anything, including my knowledge of myself. Not like when I'm sleeping. There was a complete absence. And to me, that would be the void. But you're saying it's the undifferentiated mess that exists before everything proceeded. Like it's like before the Big Bang.
Yeah, I mean, there had to be. I mean, it's there. We can't. It's hard for us to comprehend because we are always aware of ourselves. Even when we're perceiving nothingness, we're still perceiving ourselves perceiving nothingness. You know, so it's hard to imagine something without us there. But we came from somewhere. You know, it starts everything. First, there's this, and honestly, we can't comprehend it. We're not really capable. We don't have the equipment within us to truly understand like what the void is. It isn't until there's actually something there that we really start to be involved in it. But that's why we create all these symbols and everything to try to reach this.
So when you're talking about the will, you're talking about the sense of creation, existence, and destruction that exists, like in Hinduism.
Yeah, well, it exists everywhere in some point, but everybody has their own sort of. You know, description of how it is and their own image that sort of represents it. But yeah, it's the cycle. It's the cycle of nature. It's the cycle of the cosmos.
Mm. You know? Where's the monster come in?
So, I mean, the monster is, there are a lot of different ways to look at monsters.
I want your personal idea about what a monster is.
Well, for me, I mean, a monster for me is that would be something where there's an imbalance. Then something becomes a monster.
Mm.
But a monster is also not everything that we think of as a monster is. I mean, that's sort of how we see it. And this isn't necessarily a monster. There are lots of things that we would see as monstrous that are elements of nature that are just. It just happens that they're outside of what. Are perceived morality, so therefore they're being monstrous. But it could also just be that they're just performing the functions of nature that don't really aren't concerned with what we, you know, consider right and wrong. You know, life feeds on life, so some things are monstrous to other things, and some things just feel, you know, this is they're just playing their part. They're just doing. They're not really thinking about this.
So there's not a monster. It's more like a process that we perceive is monstrous.
Right, and then in you know, art and myth and everything, monsters are these creatures, and they are these, you know, gods and everything. But they're also just they're metaphors for everything. Like they are our anxieties, they are our fears. Sometimes we make something monstrous just to show that it is you know, it's not human, it's outside of us. And it, you know, it frightens us, but at the same time, we're in awe of it. You know,
can humans become monstrous?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the greatest sort of myth ever told is the one where, you know, that's been going on since the dawn of creation. We're living in it right now. So we have gods and monsters, and you know, heroes and villains, and you know, right here, right now. And just because we can't see the bat wings and the dragons. And the Cyclops heads and the magic axes, it doesn't mean they're not there. We just have to find the right way to look at the world, and then we'll see them. So they're certainly human monsters.
Excellent. Now, you work in pen and ink, which I used to do in my youth. So did you find self-flagellation not enough? Because I know what goes on with the pen and ink. And I noticed on your website, the first picture you see... is what happens when you work with pen and ink.
Well, yeah, that's that the splatter with everything.
Yeah.
Which you could look at. There's some stuff emerging from the void right there.
Yeah, I think the void is eating it up.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the cycle.
But, I mean, so how did you gravitate towards pen and ink? Because it is, for people who don't know, it is a, no matter how carefully you are, you're going to be brought down eventually. It's like humans against the sea. Eventually, you're going to get... screwed over. And if you're working with detailed work like you are, James, it can have disastrous outcomes.
Well, sure. I've, you know, over time, I've developed a much steadier hand. So, you know,
that won't last long.
Knock on wood, you know, major accidents have been, you know, it's been far fewer in recent years.
Oh, but, good. Talk to me about, and this is a technical question, and just as a person who used to do lots of pen and ink, what's your preferred pen and nib and ink?
Okay, so I usually just use, I have a wide variety. People have gifted me nibs, and I don't even know where they came from. They've just given me a bunch of nibs.
So, wait a minute. So if you're thinking of what to give James for his birthday.
Yes, please. I'll
go to Nibs or Us. Well, you, well, Nibs don't last forever. People don't understand that.
They don't, but I've actually found, so I have all these different nibs that have all these different points on them, but, you know, they wear down at different, you know, different amounts over time. So I don't throw the nib away. What I do is I just mark that nib with a different number, and I create another nib.
Cool.
Now this is
very
my
cool.
Fine point.
Yep, yep.
And so I end up with this huge array of all these different tools that are just from the different wear on the different nibs. So the more I work, the more I'm able to generate, you know, different, you know, widths and thicknesses and lines and everything. So
very cool. Very cool.
My tools are constantly expanding.
I love the fact that you saved the old ones.
Yeah, I mean they. You know, old soldiers, you know,
I totally see it. I totally get it. Back, I'm really old, James. Back when I did pen and ink art, you didn't have much of a choice. I mean, basically, I was using a crow quill with whatever ink I could get my hands on because I was, you know, I had no money. And then when the rapidograph came out, it was like a godsend. So I was like, wow, it's perfect. But you would never work with the rapidograph.
No, I just like the, you know, the bottle of ink and the nib. I like the it's a simple process, but
it is.
You know, it's very meticulous, and there's that connection to antiquity. Originally, I was a printmaker. Originally, I did intaglio and etching.
Oh, nice.
Was sort of what I focused on. And then when I got out of college, I didn't have access to a printing press. And so an etching needle and a dip pen are very similar, just in not only in the meticulous process, the amount of time you have to spend developing, you know, line and developing the piece, but it's just a very direct kind of process. You're just working with this line, and so it was a natural transition for me. I mean, I did have to do.
Well, I totally see what you're talking about, because that to me was always the allure of pen and ink. First of all, it's very portable, and and second of all, it's not expensive, and it's available to anybody. And there is that historical connection you actually feel when you dip a pen in ink and make a line on paper. It's a very old process.
Yeah, India ink has been around for, you know, centuries. There's still India ink, and it's super permanent and archival. So there's drawings in India ink that, you know, from like China, that are, you know, ancient China, that are still around, you know. So it's You're really working. You're working with antiquity, and you're hopefully you're working for antiquity. Like maybe somebody, this will still be around long after you're gone. You know.
Oh, I totally see it. I want to talk about your evolution as an artist. Now, when I talk to different artists, everyone has a different story about when they started making artwork. Were you one of those children that was always drawing?
Yes, I was certainly. You know, I think if you're an artist, you're just an artist. You're just born an artist. You know, it's not really something you have any choice in. You know,
okay.
Sometimes you don't necessarily have your medium yet. You haven't figured out how to do it. You know? So you might be an artist, but you haven't really found, you know, what kind of art you're going
to do. What appealed to you as a young person? Both imagery and material.
So my mother is a bit of an archivist. So
that'll help. That helps.
We have evidence of my early work in crayon.
Very cool. Is she still alive?
Or not, is she? Yeah, she's alive. She was at. She enjoyed the show immensely.
That's great.
So my early crayon drawings, believe it or not, a lot of them are dragons eating people. So in terms of imagery.
Yeah, but I think that's very typical. I did dinosaurs eating people.
Yeah,
and
I love dinosaurs.
Yeah. And I think that for that reason, but I think it's great that she saved those drawings. Have you ever gone back and then looked at them?
I have. I'm supposed to go up into the attic one of these days.
Oh, you got to do it, man. You got to do it. Well, there'll be a lot of an emotional thing that'll go on, a whole emotional dialogue, and it'll be very interesting what you come out of that with.
Yeah, you know, it's you talking to your younger self. And
so you talk to me about gravitating towards printmaking, because that's very sophisticated and interesting too, and
yeah,
also, you know, a very old art form.
It is, and I found that I really like these antique sort of art. I like feeling that I'm continuing the tradition. I'm keeping this alive.
Yeah,
you know, and I feel that connection to that continuity. You know, but printmaking, honestly, my first printmaking class. I was going to be a painter, and then like freshman year of art school. I was just trying to fill out, you know, my classes for the year, and I took a lithography class, which I had no idea what it was. It just wasn't at 8:30 in the morning. So I was like, okay, I can get up for this. And I took it, and I loved the process. And then from that, I found intaglio, like, you know, copperplate etching.
Yep.
And that just, I mean, just all the technique, all the process, and spending so much time just building this image and working with it. Wow. And there was also this certain amount of surprise, because you're working on the plate and then you print it. You have an idea of what's going to be there, but the medium pushes back at you a little bit.
That's right.
Which is something pen and ink, you know, does too. So sometimes it sort of tells you what you were originally thinking is not what we're going to be doing. You know, the art tells you what it wants to be.
Did you do color prints?
You know, I did. Originally, I used to be very colorful. And like I used to do very loose sort of Kandinsky style painting, and yeah, we did like 3-plate prints, and
wow,
we did viscosity prints.
Well, wait, I want to know about these Kandinsky paintings you did. Abstracts?
Yes, abstracts. And but what I found was, I mean, you just I'd be painting these abstract paintings, and then I'd start, you know, filling them in. Like, there'd be more and more little abstractions within them.
Uh-oh.
And then the abstractions would sort of become little.
You're going down the rabbit hole, James.
I realized that what I was painting was really the background, and then I was populating them. And after a while, you know, the whole world started to emerge.
That's really fascinating. And so eventually you just got rid of the background entirely.
Well, yeah, or the backgrounds just became more organized and complex, and, you know, it just, they sort of became more part of the world than just the background.
I love that. Do you still have your color prints?
I do.
I hope you do.
Somewhere. I still,
for God's sakes, give them to your mother.
You know, actually, she's trying to get rid of stuff. She's like,
oh, she's deaccessioning. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, she wants the stuff out of the house. So I'm supposed to have that stuff now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are, and always a pleasure to talk to him, Nick Capasso, director of the Fitchburg Art Museum. And we've been talking to James Dye. An exhibition of his work titled The Void, The Wheel, and The Monster is on view at the Fitchburg Art Museum until September 13th, 2026. James, I want to talk about your spiritual evolution.
Okay.
Talk about it.
My spiritual evolution?
If there's none, that's cool.
What do you mean, like in terms of like a religious? Or
No. Well, not so specific, but obviously your imagery. It comes from mythology and mythology that you've made up. Like, I don't think possums are in too many myths.
Possums are psychopomps to me. They deal with the dead. So,
do you see a lot of possums?
You know, I don't see that many, but I think the possums prefer that. You know, so I think they're out there.
I think people.
Job, and that's,
I think people totally freak out when they actually see a possum up close because they look so like rats on acid.
Well, there you go. That's the monster right there.
No, and they're also a marsupial. They're a marsupial, so they have their babies in a pouch.
But, you know, I think possums they're a very misunderstood creature. They're so important to us. They're out there doing their job. And they're, you know, they're cleaning up the dead. And
animals are throughout your works.
They have a lot of symbolic meaning, a lot of emotional meaning, you know, for everyone. Really, you know, so
talk to me about you in the natural world then.
We live in the natural world, and I find the natural world incredibly inspiring. Like, I'll flip over a rock and you see the entire world underneath there, you know, and that can be the seed for a piece right there. Just there's worlds within worlds within worlds.
I love flipping rocks and logs. It's amazing, and people who don't do it have no idea what they're missing.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just have to be aware of what's around you. And, I mean, yeah, there's just worlds, within worlds forever just around you all the time. You just have to sort of open your eyes and look around.
Well, talk back to your spiritual. Did you get very interested in certain authors or religions or mythologies?
So I would say, I grew up in a household with a lot of Joseph Campbell.
Okay. That explains a lot.
There you go, right? And a personal hero of me would be William Blake.
Okay, really, absolutely.
His philosophy that, you know, imagination is the point. Imagination is our direct connection to the divine and to, like, the greater sort of, you know, untouched, you know, raw cosmos and everything. That underpins my work quite a bit because, you know, imagination connects us back to that deeper well of primal imagery. And, you know, there's the symbolic language that we use to try to represent those, you know, primal concepts. And then each of us personally has this dialect that we develop of this language that is informed, you know, it wears the costumes and the masks informed by our personal experiences and our life. So, you know, Joseph Campbell said that dream is the personalized myth and myth is the depersonalized dream. So myth is metaphor dealing with all of humanity and dream is metaphor dealing directly with us. And so when I'm creating my work, I'm trying to manifest my own unique personal variations of my dialect of this language.
Your personal mythology.
Yes, these are my thought forms and my creatures, but they are, you know, the costumes and the masks of, you know, for my personal dialect, that of that sort of greater universal language. And anybody looking at them is going to be seeing it kind of, they're going to be translating it into their dialect. They're
right.
going to see the story through the colored by the window that they see the world, which is colored by their own experiences. So there's the story that I have written into the piece sort of is going to be different than what they see. And I encourage that. I want them to get into the work, find something to connect with, and, you know, find the narrative there that speaks directly to them.
Talk to me about starting the work. Now, before you start the work, do you have the idea? Do you sketch things out, or how does it begin?
So I fill sketchbooks all the time, you know, because just doodling and sketching and just working is how you really kind of talk into your unconscious a lot there. And anything can really spark the work, the first seed. Like, I could flip a rock and, you know, suddenly there's the idea. And but it's just sort of this one, that's just to be one form or maybe just one design that gets me into the piece. And then from there, you know, I'm a surrealist. If you have to give me an ist, I would be a surrealist. So I'm letting my unconscious sort of, it's, you know, free on the work. And the story that I'm building is something I'm having, it's a conversation I'm having with the work itself.
Mm-hmm. So it flows. There's no advanced planning. There's some planning, but then really the details just sort of flow as you go.
Well, it's a combination because I'm also, remember, this is going to be in ink, so it's a combination of planning it out.
I always forget that.
It's a combination of.
So you've really sold your soul to the ink well.
I have. It's a combination of doodling and drafting because I'm trying to be very free, but at the same time, I have to plan the piece in a way that when I start outlining it and putting the ink in, it's going to, you know, the textures are going to work together and the blacks and everything. So I have to think of all that in my head as I'm trying to be free.
Also, the works are very balanced visually.
Yeah,
some of them are circular, but other ones they're balanced in an interesting way. We're going to run out of time, but I want to ask you about one piece because I always like decapods in artwork. Talk to me about Sentinel.
Sentinel.
Yeah, you got a the decapod is the centerpiece.
the big lobster entity there.
Well, crayfish.
Yeah, well, there you go. You know, that's again, it's one I. You know, I don't want to tell you, it's hard to dissect something without killing it. So I don't
okay, good. James, I respect that. I respect that.
Okay.
But I love the fact that you picked a decapod as the centerpiece. You don't see invertebrates too much in art.
Well, there's your connection. And, you know, that got you into the work, so you can sort of build your story from there. I do feel like that one is, it's called Sentinel. So right there, the title is usually my final critique at the end of what I think the work is about. So I do think this is sort of a guardian of the well kind of piece, if I have to give it.
It looks very Kabbalistic, too.
Sure. You know? there's, you know, there's this idea of secret knowledge that exists in a lot of these systems. Like there's this great revelation that's just waiting for you. And if you can find it, you can sort of elevate to the next level. But there's always a built-in way that no one's ever able to communicate that because it's so vast that they can't really explain it to you without you taking the journey yourself. So if there's, you know, if there's secret knowledge within the piece, you know, I wouldn't be able to tell you about it because, you know, then I'd just vanish.
Or you'd have to kill them.
Yeah.
James, we're almost out of time, so I want to bring Nick back in. Nick, you can wake up now.
Okay.
I didn't mean to cut you out. But
it's fine.
And I haven't finished talking to James, but that's okay. We're literally down to the minutes. Remind people again about the dates of the show.
Okay, the show, The Void, the Wheel, and the Monster, runs through September 13th.
And
Fitchburg Art Museum.
The Fitchburg Art Museum. What else is going on there? Is there any other shows?
Oh gosh, yes. One of the main attractions right now is a show called Kaleidoscope. Ooh. 100 years of collecting for our community.
We did an interview about that. That's a great
idea. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a salon hung show with 500 works for the collection.
People have got to just show up. If you've never been to the Fitchburg Art Museum, go. It's an experience. But see this show,
also,
too. See James Dye's works.
Free.
Oh, God.
Free admission for all.
That's Nick.
Celebrate our centennial.
My guests tonight have been Nick Apasso, director of the Fitchburg Art Museum, and James Dye. An exhibition of his work titled The Void, The Wheel, and The Monster is on view at the Fitchburg Art Museum until September 13th, 2026. James and Nick, thank you so much for being here. And James, good luck with The Void.
Thank you. You too.
you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.